Beyond Fifth podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. This is Ellie Groves, and today I will be joined by OnFIF Chief Economist and Director of Research, Dinai Kirakapulu, and we will be taking a look back at what a year 2020 has been, including the impact of COVID-19 and subsequent central banking response, as well as those from the finance ministries and the European Union, the preeminent future challenges from technology, innovation, and making a case for CBDCs, to the growth of the green finance agenda. We will touch on the changing geopolitical shifts, including starting 2021 with a new US administration. And of course, having had the Brexit debate peppering the year, it is coming to a head in December for the January deadline. But tonight, I would first of all like to start with the health event which took over the year, COVID-19. Please could you have a think back to our July bulletin where we discussed uncharted waters navigating the post-COVID recovery, and also think on the impact that COVID-19 had on the world economy and the response to it from the financial world.
Thanks, Ellie. Yes, that's a lot of topics going on. And I think when we look back at where we were a year ago, we're recording this in December 2020, was a very different world. And we were discussing about when would the next crisis hit, what would it be like, how would policymakers react to it. I think none of us expected this to be the form of it, a crisis emanating from the real economy. I think we were looking mostly at financial markets, at asset prices being supported by expansionary monetary policies, and when the turning point would be. They survived big shocks like the Trump election or the vote in the Brexit referendum, and still managed to continue on a very positive trend. And I think as the COVID crisis hit, we were discussing that in the next crisis, a lot of policies have or had reached their limits at the time. We were already at the zero lower bound in many central banks. Quantitative easing programs were very, very large, and we were discussing how to unwind them. I think we've been proven wrong, or perhaps on the positive side, there's been a lot of innovation by central banks. It's been a big crisis for the real economy that has affected how people spend and work. And in an interesting sense for government, it's also been a very difficult decision that on the one hand, you're telling people not to spend, not to engage in economic activity. And on the other hand, you have to put in place programs to support economic activity and support the economy. So there is a paradox there. I think central banks have done well to make sure that what is a crisis in the real economy does not become a financial crisis as well. We saw a lot of innovation from the world's biggest central banks. The Federal Reserve created, for example, swap lines with some of the, and repo lines with some of the world's other central banks that needed access to the dollar at the time. Also innovated in terms of its own operations to support the U.S. economy. We saw from the European Central Bank flexibility and innovation with its pandemic emergency purchase program, and also the new lending operations and tweaked lending operations to support the banking system. Also the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and importantly also emerging market central banks that started to introduce quantitative easing programs. And of course, on the OnFIF website, we have the central bank policy tracker that tracks all these movements and how balance sheets have grown. I think we are also going to see some very long-lasting effects from the COVID-19 crisis in terms of how people approach the economy, workplace, working conditions. A lot of companies on the micro level have introduced flexible working arrangements, working from home arrangements. I think a lot of these are here to stay and will affect many sectors, from the travel industry to the real estate sector. So we are going to see some big structural changes in the global economy as a result of this pandemic. Even though the vaccine may be coming, we are all looking forward to returning to some sort of normality, but I think what is normal will be changed after this year.
Thank you. What do you think of the response from the European Union specifically? And do you think that the EU Next Generation Fund is a step towards a fiscal union? Or do you think that it is a response that has been put forward within a crisis, which definitely, when we go back to normal, post-vaccine and recovery, that will be perhaps not forgotten about, but put on the back burner? Do you see it as a step towards fiscal unity, or as soon as we're back to normal, a continuation of normal will kick in?
Thanks, Ellie, and thanks for raising this, because I spoke a lot about central banks, but actually the thing that I didn't mention is that unlike previous crises, the central banks were not the only game in town this time. And I think a lot of the developments that you've mentioned in the European Union are things that were long overdue, that we were debating in the euro area sovereign debt crisis already before. And yes, this is now a shock that hit the European Union in an asymmetric way. It was an exogenous shock. It just happened by an unfortunate coincidence, hit hardest in the beginning countries that were also least able to respond in terms of their economic circumstances. For example, Italy comes to mind. I think it was the right response to have the EU Generation Fund as a response to that. I think in terms of whether that is a longer term shift and change, there is still a big debate going on in the EU around this. And there's different views. There's some that think that this is the way Europe should have gone before, and the pandemic has been an important trigger for that to happen. But there's also forces that oppose that and want to temper how permanent such a program and such a direction is. So I think we will see, in the classic EU way, some sort of middle way between these forces that want to see more Europe and more of these kind of programs and those that are perhaps more conservative in terms of Europe moving in that direction.
Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about the future challenges, and a lot of the EU Next Generation Fund focuses on the transitioning to a green economy and also technological innovation. But ONFIF this year set up two institutes. So we set up the Sustainable Policy Institute and also the Digital Money Institute. So I think it would be interesting to touch on these developments and also look towards the ESG report that ONFIF published in September, the role of data in sustainable investments. So perhaps let's focus on the transitioning to a green economy issues that we will be taking up as part of the recovery from COVID, not just in Europe, but it has been a wider discussion across the whole of the world around how the ESG and green agenda can really push forward the COVID-19 recovery. But also it brings in its own risk, obviously the climate risk, and is the potential next shock. So please, could you give an overview on the role of banking regulation and supervision in tackling climate change, but also wrap that into the climate risk management that we are seeing with who we speak to at ONFIF within 2020 and going into 2021?
Yeah, thanks, Ellie. COVID has been a storm for the global economy. I think climate change is really the tsunami that's coming and that we have to prepare ourselves against. And the report that you mentioned, the role of banking regulation and supervision in tackling climate change, we published that together with Mazars in February before COVID. And we were documenting there how policymakers, regulators, central banks were really preparing for a lot of regulatory measures for the banking industry to help them prepare and protect their portfolios from climate risks. I think when COVID hit, there was a fear by some in the community that this agenda would be perhaps receive less attention because COVID, rightly so, demanded a lot of government attention, resources from regulators, from finance ministries. And climate change is a longer term issue that some may see as a luxury when what you're focusing on is whether a business will survive the next day. But I think actually what we've seen is that COVID has intensified people's awareness of how vulnerable our economic system and structures are to non-financial risks, risks that may come from completely outside the financial system. And climate risk is, of course, such an example. So I think in an interesting way, it has accelerated this agenda even more. And when we look, for example, at the central banks and supervisors network for greening the financial system, it has gone from strength to strength. It now counts 77 members. A lot of central banks are putting a lot of emphasis on that. Of course, there have been some pragmatism as well. For example, the Bank of England decided to postpone its climate stress test because of the pressures that the banking sector was facing at the time. But as we wrote also in the report that you mentioned that we published together with Refinitiv in September on the role of data in sustainable investment, we are seeing very, very big advances there. And that is helping better manage climate risks, understanding risks in portfolios, and also how the financial system is impacting factors like the environment. And I think there's a lot of interest in that now because of the pandemic.
Thank you. I think recently we had a very interesting conversation which you moderated in partnership with the British Embassy in Madrid on sustainable investment and the public-private relationships that are needed to push forward for real sustainable green investments. Do you see that the landscape for investors is shifting and changing? We obviously put for OMFIF does the GPI, so the Global Public Investor, and we did our questionnaire into that just after the pandemic had hit. Did you see at that point any shifts and changes into how global public investors were viewing their assets and also the climate risk within the context of COVID? And do you expect that that will strengthen or change into 2021? How do you think the investors will look at climate looking into 2021 in the context of what has happened this year with a public-private relationship as well?
Yes, that was a very interesting discussion we had with the British Embassy in Madrid about the role of infrastructure and infrastructure as an asset class, renewables. I think what we're seeing this year is this unprecedented fiscal stimulus programs that a lot of governments are putting in place. And this, of course, will have issues around debt sustainability and public finances, which we can go into. But I think the interesting thing about it is that there will be a lot of opportunities for these government projects. A lot of them will be in infrastructure, I think, especially in Europe, where there is a big need to revamp and update infrastructure that is in many countries very old, has not been invested in. When you look at the kind of historic timelines of the share of GDP in investments in infrastructure, it has been under what economists consider the desirable around 2% level for many years, for many OECD economies, especially in Europe. So you do have that need to upgrade infrastructure. And I think with government policy and fiscal stimulus this year, there are big, important and investment opportunities for investors that want to engage in that. I think there's also a realization that we don't want to just build infrastructure for the economy of yesterday, not want to build more roads for normal cars, want to build facilities for electric vehicles. Also with the pandemic and crowded spaces, public transport needs to be thought of differently. So definitely public-private partnerships for more sustainable-minded infrastructure will provide huge opportunities as the Build Back Better agenda takes center stage. In terms of global public investors, what we found in our report this year, which was the survey, as you said, was done as COVID was still evolving around April time, was that quite a few as public asset owners for the first time said that they plan to invest more in government bonds than exit investments in government bonds. And I think that shows that they are kind of seeing that return to safety as something more important in this volatile environment. There was still a shift to more risky asset classes because of the low yields in traditional fixed income products. So there was more appetite for things such as equities or real assets. But I think it's interesting also that there was that return to safety that we saw this year.
Thank you. I want to touch on another institute that we have, that OMFIF has developed this year, looking at digital money and the case for CBDCs and the role of blockchain. We've had quite a lot of activity in this area from a bulletin in April looking at Southeast Asia's cooperation in crisis and also the four trigger points for CBDCs and the GND currency technology. So we've done a few reports in this area, we've done a lot of meetings and we've done a lot of our bulletin articles. So please do look them up if this is an area that listeners are interested in, on the role of CBDCs and digital currency development here, especially when we look at the role of new technologies within the recovery, but also where the financial global world is currently. Would you like to just offer a little bit of light on what OMFIF has been doing in this area and where you think that the key developments are still needed for a development of a CBDC and a conversation around the technological innovation?
Yeah, thanks, Ellie. We have launched the Digital Monetary Institute this year, which has facilitated conversations between central banks and technology providers, big tech giants, as they're called. And I think it is something that was already very much at the forefront of policymakers' agendas and minds before the pandemic hit. I think if anything, the agenda of need for faster electronic payments, because in a lockdown situation, you cannot use cash. A lot of it is the kind of takeaway economy and takeaway and order at home. I think for a lot of, especially the emerging world, it's something that plays very much to the financial inclusion agenda as well. We published a report together with AWS on the use of cloud and fintech for financial inclusion in Asia last month. And I think it is a big challenge for a lot of these economies. How can you move to a more digital economy without having the fast payments and the infrastructure to support that? And digital currencies is something that a lot of them are thinking about very seriously. But it's not only been an emerging economy discussion. Christine Lagarde, president of the ECB, has been very vocal about the digital euro this year. It is also going into 2021, thinking about its strategic review, and that will be part of it as well. Other advanced economies are also progressing with their experiments and innovations, both on the wholesale CBDC and retail CBDCs, economies such as Sweden, Canada, and others that are working on this. So I think it is still a conversation to continue. It's about the future of money. It's about financial inclusion. It will have implications for monetary policy as well, especially as we are reaching the zero lower bound with a lot of major economy central banks already at zero or negative interest rates, and retail CBDCs can enable economies to move beyond that. So I think they are discussions that will dominate the next years in terms of how money is thought about and what characteristics it has.
Thank you. We are coming to the end of this very interesting podcast. We've covered a lot of ground already, but I want to slightly shift gears and look at the geopolitical landscape. We're obviously coming to the end of a very uncertain year, which has seen not only the health crisis turned economic crisis of COVID-19, but also the continuation of Brexit discussions and the very important election in the US, which potentially might see shifts in the geopolitical relationships between Europe, US and China. We've also seen China taking a different role on the world stage due to supply chain disturbances through COVID-19. And so it'd be interesting to end on this wider discussion. We've had a lot of bulletins and meetings as well, peppering the year on Brexit negotiations. We're a few days away from either heading into a no-deal scenario or clinching a deal at the last minute. I think the discussions that we've very much heard is that they will be happening right up into the wire. So while we don't know what might happen, we've had conversations with a lot of policymakers this year to gauge some understanding on Brexit and also the US and China relations. Obviously, with a new US administration, we might find that the world goes back to multilateralism and that the Biden administration, perhaps it is widely considered to be back to normal in relation to what we've seen with the Trump administration. But it would be interesting to see how you think that these wider geopolitical shifts might impact the financial landscape and also impact the decisions that we might see from investors over into 2021.
Thanks, Ellie. Yes, geopolitics do not stop even at a time of a global pandemic. And we have had a very important election in the US. There will be a very marked change in the direction of policy. I think in some cases also with the world that we've seen before under President Trump, of a world of trade wars, investment wars, currency wars, I think we may see that direction change under the new president, perhaps not to the extent that many expect. There's also the kind of China side to that, and a lot of that will be dependent on it as well. It's a two-way story. But as you said, we have published a lot of commentaries around this. Our US chairman, Mark Sobel, has published a lot on this. Our chairman, David Marsh, has published on the renminbi and what it means for the currency dynamics. Looking more closer to home, in Europe. Of course, Brexit is something that, as we're recording this on the 15th of December, is very much at people's front of people's mind. That and the news that London is moving into tier 3 restrictions for lockdown, I think, are dominating the headlines. We're still far from a deal. The EU has taken a similar approach to previous crises where it's had to face tough negotiations. I recall not that long ago, the euro area sovereign debt crisis and the negotiations with Greece again going to the wire and negotiations through the midnight and to the early hours of the day and finally coming out with a deal. I think in some cases that is way policymakers work, and you do need to show that you are pushing your line very hard until you arrive at a deal. We still don't know whether that will be the case or not. I think the uncertainty has hurt businesses in the UK, but at the same time, you know, the EU has been very united on that front more than any other issue it's faced so far. I mean, even with the Greek sovereign debt crisis, there was more divisions within the EU about how to approach that. I think with Brexit, it's been very much a one line, and I imagine policymakers in the EU sitting around the table looking forward to discussing Brexit as something that they're finally united about and having that kind of collaborative mood. But it's a sobering situation also for the EU. There will be implications for it as well, but I think the pandemic has really eclipsed anything else in terms of the threats that the EU sees in its economy and society. So I think the focus of EU policymakers has been elsewhere. Brexit has become more of a British issue for now, but it will be a no deal would be very painful for both sides, more so for the UK, and it is to be avoided.
Thank you very much. I think that what we see into 2021 is a continuation of a focus on COVID-19 recovery and the transition to a green economy and the technological innovations. But the geopolitical shifts with the new US administration and also the new relationship for Europe and the UK will be an interesting one to keep an eye out for. If we were making predictions this time last year, and you had said we'll have a pandemic that will fade for the whole year and we will still be thinking about it for many years to come, you might not have been able to predict that. But as this is a wrap-up of 2020, please could you also offer your predictions for 2021? So where do you think will be the key areas that the policymakers will be focusing on? Obviously COVID-19, but do you think that there is anything else that we haven't covered in a wrap-up of 2020 that might become more of an issue within 2021?
I don't know if it will come up already in 2021, but I think an emerging issue that will come to the forefront in the coming years will be the tension between fiscal policy and monetary policy. I think, you know, central banks have reacted very aggressively in a good way to support the financial system from what's going on in the real economy. I don't think you can have that divergence for a very long time. It's not sustainable. For now, the real economy has been on a worse path than the financial system, and at some point they need to align. And I think another issue will be the tension when it comes to debt sustainability as well, because if at some stage inflation comes up and there's big question marks around that, we should have another complete new podcast about it. But some economists do worry about a situation where we have a low growth, high inflation scenario, and what will central banks be called to do then, follow their inflation price stability mandates that may come in a political tension with treasuries that are pursuing more of a growth strategy for their economies and calling for less tightening approach by the central banks. I think we could see some political tensions there. I don't think we'll see that as early as 2021, but it is something to keep at the back of our minds, given the huge fiscal stimulus that we're seeing. And we did write a commentary about that, what happens when interest rates rise. It's a series we are starting. We did the first one for the Bank of England. It's on our website, and we go really through the mechanics and the details of how that would work out, what would happen, what considerations would the central bank have against the Treasury. We concluded that technically it's not going to be a tension, but it could be a political one.
Thank you very much. That is definitely one to watch. And I think it's safe to say that 2020 has been a unique year with its challenges and I think that it's been very interesting to go through these with you today, Danai. So thank you for that. We hope that you've enjoyed another year of OnFIF podcast as well to those who have listened in. And please do subscribe to our channel. And do not forget to take a look at the OnFIF bulletins and reports for on our website for more in-depth information. Thank you again for listening. And thank you, Danai, for joining us. I hope that everyone stays safe and has a happy holiday season and a new year. And we look forward to welcoming everybody back on the podcast in 2021.